Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, November 28th. So let's start out with the Dubai World situation. To refresh your memory, as I myself did, the United Arab Emirates is a federation of seven independent sheikhdoms, of which Abu Dhabi and Dubai are the best known and two largest. Sharjah is third. Oil was first discovered in Abu Dhabi in the early 1960s, and the price spike in the 70s transformed an impoverished region into one of the world's wealthiest. In 1971, British troops withdrew from the Persian Gulf, and the United Arab Emirates was formed. Abu Dhabi is more than six times the size of the other six states put together and provides the federal capital city of Abu Dhabi. As for the number two state, Dubai, it doesn't have the oil that Abu Dhabi does, but it became the destination resort, so to speak, for all kinds of capital from around the world, including the oil riches from Abu Dhabi, Dubai's big brother. Of course, Dubai has been featured often in this space, and I've chronicled the real estate bubble that now threatens the government's finances, at least Dubai's. So on Wednesday, Dubai World, which is the main corporate entity for the Dubai government, with most of its investments in real estate and port operations, declared it wanted relief from making any debt payments for 6 months. Seeing as Dubai World has $59 billion in debt, of $80 billion total for the Dubai government, this caused a bit of a stink, especially when those who released a statement saying they wouldn't be making any debt payments in the interim decided to take a three-day holiday. One of Dubai World's subsidiaries, Nakheel, the builder of the famous tree-shaped islands you all have seen pictures of, has a debt payment of $3.52 billion due on December 14th, with another $5.5 billion of Dubai World debt due over the coming 4 months. Needless to say, many banks, both in the Middle East and, as it turns out, Europe, but not in the U.S., are on pins and needles awaiting further word on just what the heck is happening. It's no wonder, then, that world markets collectively gasped, fell about 4%, but then recovered some. Here in the United States, we were saved by the Thanksgiving holiday and only declined about 1.5% on Friday and finished essentially unchanged on the week. Dubai's growth over the past decade has been absurd. Countless celebrities, from Brangelina to the Beckhams, have been taken in, and stands to lose millions on real estate that is down 50% in less than 1.5 years as the global financial crisis compounded a simple fact. Dubai is way overbuilt, both office and residential. Today, more than 400 projects worth some $300 billion are either canceled or are on hold. But aside from the fact everyone's waiting to see what the Emirates' big players are going to do next and how much money the banks could end up losing in any restructuring of the debt, as well as the issue of whether Abu Dhabi will come to the rescue of its arrogant kid brother, it's the issue of credibility, as in Dubai's is shot. It's the way of the bazaar, really. There's a history of deceit and excess. I do have to say, however, that one issue that was not covered on Friday while I had CNBC on was a familiar one, counterparty risk. When word broke of the potential for a large default in Dubai, the cost of credit default swaps to insure against losses both there and other similar risk soared. But no one talked about who might be on the other side of these trades should they have to make good. As in, do we have another AIG on our hands? Have we not learned our lessons? Nope. I suspect that could be part of this coming week's narrative. Meanwhile, the world continued to turn, and as far as I could tell, there were still 24 hours in a day. Each year I ask Santa for 26, and he just laughs. The economic data for the week was all right. Sure, third quarter GDP was lower to 2.8% from 3.5%, but a downward revision was expected. Existing and new home sales for October came in very strong, both better than expected, and the S&P Case-Shiller Index for September showed home prices were up a fourth straight month, though barely. But then you have the data on a typical mortgage holder and how 1 in 4 today are underwater, 40% among those who bought at the 2006 peak, which means there are far more foreclosures to come. At least single-family home prices in all of California rose an eighth consecutive month in October, a further sign of stabilization in this critical market, though the median home price is still off 50% from the peak. The data on personal income and consumption for October was better than expected, particularly in the case of the latter, but hardly anyone is translating a better consumer spending figure into strong holiday sales. I'm not commenting on Black Friday except to say it's irrelevant when gauging the next 4 weeks in total. What we do know is that according to an Associated Press GFK poll, 93% say they'll spend less or about the same as last year. Separately, jobless claims for the week fell below the critical 500,000 mark for the first time in ages, and credit card delinquency rates are falling as well, both good. The Federal Reserve released the minutes from its last FOMC meeting, and the Fed conceded that there are risks of asset bubbles and inflation from keeping short-term rates so low for as long as they are projected to do so, but that the actual odds of either were minimal. Looking to 2010, the Fed sees paltry growth with unemployment still in the 9.3 to 9.7% range come a year from now, which isn't real good, sports fans. Overseas, Morgan Stanley economist Stephen Roach had some extensive comments in the South China Morning Post, reiterating that China is walking a fine line between bubbles and further stimulus. Roach, who is consulted regularly by Beijing, said China knows what it needs to do in steering the economy away from an export-focused one to one of increased domestic consumption. But the execution of a plan efforting this hasn't been there. Roach also brings up a hugely important point. China's virtually no safety net for its rapidly aging population. Separately, the Chinese government continues to make waves that the day of loose money is over when it comes to bank lending, and that increased capital requirements will be mandated next year. That's one way of slowing the asset bubbles there, particularly the property one. In Japan, unemployment continued to tick down for a fourth month, just 5.1%, as stimulus programs work and the consumer begins to spend more. But deflation is very much in the cards as consumer prices for October fell a near-record 2.2%. In the Eurozone, a leading manufacturing index rose in November, but bank lending, just as in the United States, remains very weak. Overall, Germany's new finance minister echoed previous warnings from the likes of China that low U.S. interest rates and a weak dollar are fueling bubbles, even if the Fed says not to worry. Wolfgang Schäuble said that low interest rate currencies, such as the dollar, are increasingly being used as a basis for currency carry trade should give pause for thought. If there was a sudden reversal in this business, markets would be threatened with enormous turbulence, including in foreign exchange markets, close quote. No argument here. The dollar is going to have its day, but it won't be as a result of Dubai World. It will be Iran. But before we get to the topic, a note on healthcare. The latest USA Today Gallup survey reveals Americans oppose the House and Senate bills by a 49-44 margin, hardly a resounding mandate for President Obama. Four Democratic senators, including independent Joe Lieberman, who caucuses with the Dems, hold the key to the upcoming Senate debate. Lieberman, Mary Landrieu, Blanche Lincoln, and Ben Nelson, with the public option being the chief bugaboo for this quartet, along with public funding of abortions. Also, when it comes to both bills in Congress, the joke is that for them to be close to fiscally responsible, aside from taxing the rich, Congress will be called on to cut spending for both Medicare and Medicaid by hundreds of billions, when Congress has never authorized a single cut of even $2 in these programs. Robert Samuelson, Washington Post. Quote, in fiscal 2008, the last normal year before the economic crisis, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, programs wholly or primarily dedicated to the elderly, totaled $1.3 trillion, 43% of federal spending, and more than twice military spending. Because workers, not retirees, are the primary taxpayers, this spending involves huge transfers to the old. Now comes the House-passed health care reform bill that, amazingly, would extract more subsidies from the young. It mandates that health insurance premiums for older Americans be no more than twice the level of that for younger Americans. That's much less than the actual health spending gap between young and old. Spending for those aged 60 to 64 is 4 to 5 times greater than those 18 to 24. So the young would overpay for insurance that, under the House bill, people must buy. 20 and 30-somethings would subsidize premiums for 50 and 60-somethings. Those 65 and over receive Medicare. That was Robert Samuelson. Well, you add all the preceding up, including any fallout from Dubai World, and you can see that we still have a very fragile global economy, and in many respects, the longer-term outlook is poor, particularly in the U.S., as we pile up debt and still try to meet our international obligations on the security front. And the banks aren't helping matters by still refusing to lend to consumers and small business as they deal with their own ongoing balance sheet issues. The states are also bleeding profusely on the revenue front, with tax collections down 11% in the recent quarter. But let's turn to Iran. By some measures, this was as infuriating a week as any. Even departing International Atomic Energy Agency Chief Mohammad El-Baradei was furious. Consider that El-Baradei really believed a final resolution to Iran's nuclear weapons program was going to be his lasting legacy, but instead he was forced to say, quote, "There has been no movement on remaining issues of concern which need to be clarified for the IAEA to verify the exclusively peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program. We have effectively reached a dead end unless Iran engages fully with us," said El-Baradei. El-Baradei knows Iran isn't about to engage. Instead, an Iranian foreign ministry spokesman said, "We are looking for 100% guarantees, whereby Iran would exchange its 3.5% enriched uranium for an equal amount, 20% enriched uranium, a total non-starter. Plus, to further show the farcical nature of it all, Iran wouldn't turn over a thimble full of uranium until it got all the 20% stuff first." What Iran has also done, however, is tick off Russia. As a senior Western diplomat told the Financial Times, "Russia is more and more upset with Iran after Iran's brutal rejection of the nuclear proposal, which was based on a Russian proposal in which Moscow itself was supposed to play a significant role. The regime took the risk of upsetting Russia, which is less compromising than before." And so, conversely, there is a chance Russia will actually back a U.S.-led bid for increased sanctions. Even China joined Russia on Friday in signing off on an IAEA censure of Iran, demanding Tehran immediately freeze construction of its COME facility and to stop enriching uranium per prior Security Council resolutions, a rare measure of unity by the P5 plus one, including the U.S., France, Britain, and Germany. For its part, Iran's representative at the IAEA meeting was defiant, and this week Iran conducted extensive war games for its air defenses, even as the mullahs continue to tell the world their nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. But here's where I feel this week could in the end have been the one that did Iran in. Nobel Peace Prize laureate Shirin Ebadi, the heroic human rights lawyer, was out of Iran at the time of the contested June presidential election, and she never returned, saying she is in an effective state of exile. It's just too dangerous for her. Her husband, for instance, was arrested and severely beaten this fall, according to the Norwegian Foreign Ministry. So with Ebadi away, on Thursday, Iranian authorities confiscated her Peace Prize medal, taking it out of a safe deposit box in Iran along with all her personal effects, including the diploma awarded with the medal. Every decent-minded person's blood should be boiling at this story. Earlier this week, Son of Satan, Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, warned that slandering officials of the Islamic establishment and spreading rumors about them are part of the enemy's enemy's soft warfare strategy, according to the Tehran Times. Such actions are in line with the wishes of the enemy because the country's officials, including the president, the majlis speaker, the judiciary chief, and the expediency council chairman, are at the helm of the country and people should trust them, said Khamenei in a meeting with the vicious Basiji in Tehran. "In this soft warfare," he continued, "the enemy is attempting to use advanced cultural and communications tools to create doubt, pessimism, and conflict among the people." That was Ayatollah Khamenei. One thing is clear, friends, the Ayatollah needs to be taken out, the entire leadership along with him. They were often all together at Friday prayers. Here's hoping they meet their end one day soon in that very spot. I assume some of you saw the 60 Minutes segment last Sunday with the Newsweek reporter, Mazir Bahari, who talked of his time in prison in Tehran. The day before, I noted in Week in Review, many of the Iranians are simply sick, totally nuts. There's no other way to describe them. Bahari, with his firsthand experience, echoed these sentiments. So how can anyone doubt that Israel is being forced to act sooner than later? Israeli President Shimon Peres said this week that Iranian threats must be taken seriously. Quote, "Ahmadinejad wants to destroy a nation and he denies the Holocaust. His ambition is to rule the Muslim world with unmitigated force and terror," close quote. The fact that he does not speak about the future, Peres continued, is indicative that he has no future. He will fall, his people will topple him, Peres predicted. Speaking at a graveside ceremony Monday, honoring Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, Peres portrayed him as a lone wolf who dedicated his life to a single vision in Israeli homeland. "What was thought at the time to be impossible to accomplish has become an amazing reality," said Peres. So Israel will act to preserve the dream, For his part, President Obama needs to speak out forcefully against the Ayatollah immediately and blast the regime for taking Ebadi's medal and savagely beating her husband. This message has to resonate among the opposition, who are wondering why we have seemingly abandoned them. It's time to hold Obama accountable on this paramount issue before it's too late. It's time for the Ayatollah, Ahmadinejad, and the rest to be sent straight to hell. Turning to the markets, we'll find out this coming week with further details in the fallout over Dubai World just how much the risk trade has been affected. This past week, though, U.S. stocks were basically unchanged, with the Dow Jones off a mere 9 points, 0.1%, the S&P 500 unchanged, and NASDAQ down 0.4%. For all the talk about gold this year, it's up less than NASDAQ, 36% to 33%. Heck, even many a high-yield bond fund is up more than gold, though I must say I think junk's run is over. I'll be back with you next Saturday, December 5th. Have a great week.